Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the first Press Gazette podcast of 2018. I'm Thomas Kavanagh, and today I'll be joined by Gareth Brown, Press Gazette's new Journalist of the Year. At just 22, Gareth flew to Iraq to report on the Battle of Mosul. I'm glad to say he's back safe and sound and joins me now. So thanks, Gareth, for coming down and welcome to the Press Gazette podcast.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be on.
So I guess I'll start with the obvious question. Why did you up and go to Iraq at the age of 22?
I guess there's no one single answer to that. You know, prior to that, I'd been studying Arabic at the University of Exeter, and I just graduated. I was kind of aware that there was this big offensive about to take place against Islamic State in the north of Iraq. And I'd studied Iraq really in depth at university. You know, I wrote my dissertation about it. I felt like I had quite a solid knowledge of the kind of the environment and the conflict I was going into. So I guess in those regards, it seemed like a no-brainer. From a professional sense, I was really interested in what was going on, and it seemed like a good place to, you know, start getting stories published and start working professionally as a journalist. And, you know, I'd probably be lying if I didn't say there was an element of adventure. You know, going to a different country and living there for a long period of time is the sort of thing I love doing anyway, and then to add all the kind of political, you know, context into that, you know, I really didn't think twice about it in some ways.
What did your family say?
That was probably one of the toughest things about going, actually. So I told my parents. I mean, I already had a brother in Iraq who was working there for the United Nations, which I think helped a little bit. When I went, I actually told my parents that I was going to Turkey. Even when my dad dropped me at Gatwick, he said, "Have fun in Turkey." You know, I told them I was going out to Istanbul to kind of set myself up there as a journalist. And then I kind of landed in Erbil in northern Iraq and didn't. I buried my head in the sand for a few weeks, and I was kind of really. That was more stressful than anything else. Kind of thinking, how am I going to tell my mother where I actually am? How am I going to get out of this little white lie? After I've been in country for about 4 weeks, and then I didn't write anything in my first 4 weeks, and then the offensive it kicked off. That was October 2016, and I was there on the first night. I mean, there were lots of journalists there, but I really was. We camped out the night before, and we went in with the Kurdish Peshmerga as they kind of went into these, you know, handful of villages held by ISIS. And I'd been tweeting about it, and I got had some producers like contacting me through Twitter. So had a load of, you know, I'd had very little published before I went out. You know, I'd done a little bit of work with some newspapers, but I'd never done any of the broadcast stuff. So I got a call from LBC Radio, and they said, "Gareth, can you, you know, give us a 2-minute interview?" And I was like, "Yeah, sure."
Whose show?
I think it was Sheila Fogarty. So I was like, "Yeah, of course." Jumped at the chance to do some radio. I was so excited, and I remember texting my mum saying, "Oh, mum, guess what? I'm going to be on the radio. Make sure you tune in."
And at this point, she didn't.
She's still in Turkey, and then on the radio, I was introduced. You know, we're going live to Gareth Brown in Mosul, Iraq, and that was how my mother found out. I think that was a 2-minute interview, and by the end of it, I had about 14 missed phone calls. lots of four letter words. But yeah.
So her reaction was very calm.
I'm not sure it was calm. She was worried like any mother would be, but I think it quickly dawned on her like how serious I was about doing it. I really wasn't there for a jolly.
Yeah.
It wasn't a gap year. You know, I was there because I was really, really, I was passionately interested in what was going on. And, you know, she always knew that that was what I wanted to do.
Mm.
And I think quite quickly she kind of learned to accept it. And I think my dad was a bit more, I won't say supportive, but sometimes he was like living vicariously through me. I think when he found out there was an element of, that's my boy, you know,
yeah,
going out there and actually doing it. But yeah, I mean, it was a bit of a shock for them, but they're, you know, mum and dad were number one fan, biggest critic at the same time. So,
so you say you landed in Erbil, that's the Kurdish part of Iraq.
Yeah.
You just flew directly there?
Yeah, I mean, that was the remarkable thing about it. It's really, it was really easy to get there. I mean, you fly to Erbil via Istanbul. You can get a budget flight for about less than 150 quid, you know. There was a lot of journalists there because it was a really, really accessible kind of story. So, yeah, I didn't, you know, it was like you could have been booking a flight anywhere. You really didn't have to. Obviously, you're considering the risks and you're thinking of contingency plans and you're generally planning as much as you can, but really there's nothing stopping you from booking a flight right now and flying out. Well, you know, the situation's changed now, but back then you could fly out on the same day you booked the ticket.
And once you landed, what were your moves when you got to the ground?
It was just trying to meet people. I mean, and you know, knowing a topic from an academic perspective or from books you've read or other documentaries you've watched is one thing, but actually being familiar with the topic on the ground is very different. So I was immediately trying to meet as many people as I could. And these were like other journalists, aid workers, government officials, you know, like, and just trying to work out, you know, what are the mechanics of operating as a journalist here? Like, I didn't have a journalist visa. That was fine. I didn't need one, but I mean, how do I, you know, there's nothing going on in Erbil. It's a safe city.
Mm.
Although, I mean, maybe to say there's nothing going on, perhaps that's inaccurate, but there wasn't the story that I was looking for in Erbil. So what are the mechanics of you know, living in Erbil and then actually getting to Mosul, to getting to the front lines, to getting to where the IDPs, the displaced people are? That's where the stories are, you know?
Mm.
So that was kind of my immediate thing. There was, you know, there was lots of, you know, people would work, you know, whether you were a journalist or a aid worker, you know, people would work really stressful weeks and then all come together kind of Friday nights. And there's some very, very memorable party, well, probably not memorable, but very large parties. You're going for a drink with other journalists and you're sharing ideas and swapping contacts and you know, and then you start to meet people who you can work together with, you know, photographers who I would go out with, or other journalists from other publications that weren't rival publications, so we could kind of share information. And that was the critical thing for me, was just going out there and meeting people, yeah, and you know, just discussing all these mechanics of operating out there.
Okay, so you're in Erbil, you've met the sort of press pool that's out there.
Yeah.
You've settled yourself in. At no point was there any fear of what was coming up?
I think, you know, that period of anticipation. No one knew exactly when the offensive was going to start, and I think it started on the 16th. In the end, 16th of October was, and you're waiting for that day, but you don't exactly know when it's going to be, and you know there is a little bit of anticipation, but it's also, you know, it's kind of an ugly secret, but it's also a little bit thrilling as well. It's a little bit exciting. You really are going into the unknown, and you know, I had like I'd come pretty much straight out of university, had a very sheltered upbringing. You know, before I went to Iraq, I'd never been to a funeral. A funeral in the UK, I'd never really had a close relative die or anything like that. So I think the first kind of shock was, you know, when you start to see, like the first time I was in combat, or the first time I was a witness to combat. You know, I can remember the first time, like, seeing a dead body. You know, this is, you're being taken out of a really sanitized environment. And then you're having all of these like kind of ethical, moral, mental challenges thrown at you, like in a very, very short space of time. And it's really concentrated. And it was, you know, that was tough to begin with. But I, I, I like to think I adapted pretty quickly, and I never wanted to really, I never thought I'd seen too much or wanted to go home because I was scared. That was never crossed my mind.
And you've gone from Erbil to Mosul.
Yeah.
And those first few days of the battle, can you just describe those?
I mean, that very first day was that's like an enduring memory that I'll never forget. Me and two other guys I've been working with, we'd heard that it was going to start at 5 a.m. or whatever the next morning, so we got our driver and we went up just as far as we could, and we stopped at this Kurdish Peshmerga base. And when we got there, we were the only ones there. And we were like, oh wow, we've got the scoop on the whole world. Mm. And we sat in this kind of enclosed Peshmerga base for about 2 hours, and then within that 2 hours, just about every journalist I had ever heard of or ever read arrived, and I was like, okay, maybe we didn't have the scoop. And I remember like CNN showed up with like 3 armored trucks or something, and I was like, right,
you're there with a pen and paper.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So then they split us out into smaller groups, and each there'd be like maybe half a dozen journalists in each group, maybe a few more, maybe 10, and you were always all put with different units, going through different villages, different towns. Yeah, I mean, we went out with our unit, and we slept in this abandoned house. And it was really surreal because, they're like, oh, just rest here for a couple of hours until we actually start moving. But no one could sleep. The anticipation was incredible. Like, you're with these soldiers who have been waiting for this battle for 2 years. And Iraq is a massive country, but what I noticed was it's impossible, whether you're in the Arab areas, whether you're in the Kurdish areas, whether you're down south in Baghdad, everyone has been personally affected by the war somehow. Mm. They have a cousin who's died, or they've been displaced from somewhere, a city that was taken over by ISIL, or they've had their house destroyed in an airstrike. Everyone has a really intense personal connection to that conflict. So waiting that night before, we were with the Peshmerga, and they... It kind of fed off that in a way. It was going to be a really, really personal fight. And I didn't sleep at all that night. I just stayed up all night just chatting to soldiers, and they were firing artillery. We could hear that going off every so often, and just kind of wandering around, and you could kind of look up into the distance and you could see Mosul, and there was very few light. There wasn't really much electricity on the seat, but there was a few lights and you could just about make them out. And, you're looking at Islamic State, which is this boogeyman, isn't it? This geopolitical boogeyman, which is, everyone knows the term, but then to actually, I guess in a way, personalise it and make it a tangible entity is a very, very different thing. And then, I think it was about 5 or 6 a.m., they said, we get the call and we just join this convoy, which must have been more than 100 vehicles long. Like, there was like MRAPs, all these kind of different armoured vehicles, trucks just carrying loads of soldiers, and then we were just in our Hilux just going forward with them. There was US Special Forces there as well, as we saw. The unit we were with were taking 3 villages, and we kind of stayed a village behind. So they were going to the first village, and we were coming down from this mountain. And you could watch the fighting going on. You could see the muzzle flashes, you could see them calling in airstrikes, you could see smoke billowing out, you could hear it, But we stayed quite far back, just to be as safe as we could, and slowly moved in. We were kind of a village behind the Peshmerga, and that was when we went into the first village. That was when I saw, there was like, a handful of dead ISIS fighters just in the streets.
Once this offensive had sort of cleared out ahead of you, what are you confronted with when you walk into this village that's been a scene of a battle?
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird mixture of like the quotidian and the surreal. You have houses which have been like left just at the click of a finger, and so they're kind of almost exactly as they were. The seconds before the people fled, and that could have been a year or two ago. So you might have like a bowl and a spoon still on the table. Someone literally fled during their breakfast. There's lots of destruction. ISIS really, they prepared that whole area for urban combat. So you could go into a house which looks perfectly fine, and then you go into the downstairs bedroom, and there's a tunnel which goes 20 meters down and a kilometer that way. you know, they used these tunnels to burrow between villages so they could hide from the airstrikes. And then, yeah, you've got this destruction. You've got everything you would expect, I guess.
And after the Battle of Mosul, you remained in the Middle East for a little while longer. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I planned to go to Iraq for like, kind of a month or two, and then it ended up being sustainable. So I stayed there for the whole battle, and I left just after they captured the it was called the Al-Nuri Mosque, where Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi kind of proclaimed the caliphate, and that was, you know, for many people that was the end of the battle. Then after that, I came back to the UK. Had a couple of months at my parents' house, like doing nothing, just kind of, I guess, taking it all in, and you know, wondering where am I going from, you know, what am I doing next, which was a really hard period, actually. It was, you know, you spend so long fixated on one story and you're absolutely obsessed with it, and you're working, like, you know, it's not a 9-to-5 job. You're just always thinking about it. And you're always trying to come up with ideas, and you're always trying to meet people. And then you, like, came back home and you have, like, nothing, you know. You get kind of withdrawal symptoms. And then, yeah, after that, I went to Beirut. I was in Beirut for 2 months. So whilst I was in Beirut, I was kind of working on stories related to Lebanon and Syria.
Were you there when the PM stepped down?
Yeah, so Hariri resigned. PM Prime Minister Saad Hariri resigned on the 4th of November. That was the day I arrived, actually. So I kind of checked my phone and...
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
So, baptism of fire.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I checked my phone and it was just going crazy. And, you know, that was a really interesting story arc to follow as well. Yeah, and then I stayed in Beirut until, New Year's Day, I think.
So you were there at Christmas?
Yeah, I was. Yeah, that was a personal choice, though. I just wanted to be out there. You know, it's weird. I feel like I'm much better conditioned to life out there. And, you know, I've never done Christmas in Beirut. And
what was it like?
Yeah, I mean, it was perfectly normal. We've got lots of friends out there, so we had a nice kind of traditional Christmas dinner. It's not too, you know, nothing too fancy, but. I just preferred being out there for special occasions. I think I like to try and keep busy, so being out there was, you know, I did a bit of work on Christmas Day as well. Like, I don't like to hang around too much.
So what's your background? Where do you come from?
So my parents are both from Northern Ireland. They left Northern Ireland a very long time ago. They moved abroad. I was born in Luxembourg, and then moved to the UK really soon after I was born. So, like, family home is Northamptonshire area. Three brothers, and yeah, I mean, I just remember, like, I went to a pretty good school, and whilst I was at school, I was absolutely, like, infatuated. I mean, it was the Arab Spring was just kicking off when I was in sixth form, and I think sixth form were really, really, you know, it's a really formative time in your life, and that was.
So you've always known that you wanted to be a journalist.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's wavered from time to time, and I do still think now that there are other things I'd like to try.
Mm.
But I always end up coming back to wanting to be a journalist. And then when I was in sixth form, I started meeting journalists then. So I met with, I remember like Paul Conroy, who was, he's a photographer for he was a photographer for the Sunday Times. He was in Syria with Marie Colvin when she was killed. I remember getting in touch with him just after he got out of Syria. And when he'd been smuggled out by the Free Syrian Army into Lebanon, and it was like, been this massive story in the UK. And I got him to come in and do a talk at my school. It must have been about 6 weeks after he came out. His words kind of just stuck with me forever. He talked so fondly of being in Syria and of Marie, who obviously tragically died. And that really kind of left an impression on me. And it's things like that I always go back to whenever I'm wavering, you know.
Mm.
You know, he was such a fantastic storyteller, and he still does. He uses those skills with his pictures, but I found he was a great speaker as well. He uses those skills to, you know, tell these stories of people whose stories really wouldn't get, it's a bit of a cliche, but they really wouldn't get out otherwise. I go back to that, and I think, you know, that's kind of the sort of thing I'm aiming for.
And you've come with some pretty huge stories from last year. You won a New Journalist of the Year award, and one I particularly recall is a mass grave that you discovered. Could you tell me a little bit more about that story? It's quite grim.
Yeah, it's interesting how you end up covering these. That story actually wasn't my my idea, I guess. One of my editors at the Times, one of the foreign editors, called me up and said it. That Reuters had broken that this grave had been found, but there was nothing. There was just the fact that this grave had been found. There was no details on it. And he said, Gareth, go and check, go and have a look into this. And I went, sure, yeah. And so the next day I went, and there were a couple of other journalists there. A couple of other journalists went that day. But myself and the other guy I was with, we really spent, you know, quite a few hours there. And we went to the, you know, we eventually found the mass grave. It was just outside of this town called Hamamalil, this like kind of small village, and it was like, there was just like nothing there. It was just like wasteland from afar. But once you got closer, you could see like the remnants of people. You could see like skulls and I think I counted probably 20 bodies or something, and they were pretty badly decomposed. So it happened a while back. And you know, we'd got there, and I was like, right, okay, I've seen this exists. This was actually the day, you know, one of the most surreal things about that day was, it was the day that Trump won the election. And I remember leaving, when we left Erbil, I kind of was looking at my phone, and then I just switched my phone off, and I was like, I don't want to follow that at all. So I was like fully focused on on the story at hand. We kind of looked around, and like, yeah, okay, we've visited this mass grave, but like, how did this happen? What's the actual story behind this? You know, we don't know who these people are. They could be ISIS fighters who were trying to run away and they were killed, or maybe they're civilians. It really wasn't obvious. So we spent, you know, most of the day in that kind of nearby town, just chatting to people. You know, do you know what happened there? And then it quickly became apparent, after speaking to maybe half a dozen people, that it wasn't just a kind of massacre, but it was actually a kind of tale of heroism. The people that had been killed there, at least some of them had been involved in an uprising against ISIS. And that was something that, I mean, there are a few more stories about it now, but back then you really didn't hear about this kind of internal resistance to ISIS. So these, you know, as the offensive started, these guys had tried to rise up against ISIS and take back control. And, you know, it had ended brutally for them. But, you know, there was people living, like, that gravesite, they were all killed in that gravesite. So it was the scene of the crime, and it was where all the bodies were left. But there were houses 200 metres, 300 metres away. And that was the kind of first, well, let's go to that house. You know, someone's, they if that happened that close to your house, you know something about it. And, you know, we were able to speak to a man who'd heard it all, basically. He'd heard it going off. He'd heard the screams. He'd heard the shots in the dead of night. And, you know, I was able to kind of reconstruct the narrative of this uprising and then ISIS gathering all the people in the village square, and some people had managed to sneak out, and, you know, their lives had been saved as a result, and lots of the kind of adult males were just kind of frog marched to this site and then executed. And yeah, I mean, it wasn't an easy story to do, but in some ways it kind of wrote itself. I mean, I think that story was 1,000 words, and I remember my editor saying, you know, this needs to be in the paper tomorrow. And I was like, I need to spend a day writing this. He's like, no, you need to get this over to us. And I wrote it in about an hour, like in the back of the car on the way back to Erbil, because it was just, the story was so strong, it kind of put itself into words.
And there's another one that I picked up on, the testing of chemicals on civilians.
Yeah.
You came across that amongst some records that ISIS had kept there.
Yeah. See, so that was a little bit different in the sense that was passed to me by some contacts. So I didn't find those documents myself, but the guys who did find them were really, really keen to get that out there.
Were they locals or journalists?
They were locals. Yeah.
Yeah.
They were local military. And you know, you don't want to shock people, but it's hard to tell people something different when it comes to speaking about the brutality of ISIS. It's really hard to make people listen, because I don't want to say it's a type of fatigue, but you hear it every single day about, you know, the violence, the gratuitous violence and the beheadings and the sexual slavery and all these things. Yet there are still elements to this group that we don't really know much about, that we haven't heard about. And this was one of those things. I mean, it's like testing this stuff on human guinea pigs. Awful. Like, in my opinion, it's as bad as anything else they've kind of carried out.
So now, pretty much, the war against ISIS, I wouldn't say that it's over, but it's at the beginning of the end. Where do you see, from your impressions that you got on the ground, where do you see Iraq going?
So maybe it's my youthfulness or naivety, but I'm quite optimistic. There's a lot of challenges facing Iraq, but I'm relatively optimistic. I think Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi is doing a fairly decent job, given the sort of pressures he's under from Iranian-backed groups, leading the fight against ISIS. He really hasn't had a moment to kind of sit still in the past couple of years. He's trying to reach out across sectarian lines. You know, he's Shia, but I really do think he is trying to reach out to Sunnis in places like Mosul and in Baghdad and in Fallujah, and speaking to people in those cities, Sunnis in those cities. You know, they're kind of, some of them have said to me, you know, actually, we're going to vote for this. We're going to vote for this guy in the election. There's an election coming up in a couple of months' time. And they say, yeah, we'll probably vote for Abadi, which is really interesting, because hitherto, post-2003 Iraq has been almost explicitly defined along sectarian lines. Like, you vote for the Sunni candidate, or you vote for the Shia candidate, if you're Shia. And now you have someone like Abadi, he's not a really charismatic individual, and he's not a very strong prime minister, but he is starting to breach these kind of sectarian barriers that have been placed. And you know, in Mosul, like, life is, at least in the east, you know, the west is a very different city because it was so leveled during the fighting, but in the east, life's returned to pretty much normal. You know, there are shops open, people are just getting on with things, and I think, you know, it's still a really precarious situation, but I think with the right kind of support from the government in Baghdad and from the international community, I think we're going to start seeing life return to this kind of semblance of normality, at least in the next few months and years. But, you know, there are still huge challenges. You know, half of Mosul was completely leveled. Like, the old city in Mosul was completely destroyed. You know, tens of thousands of civilians were killed, and there hasn't really been any accountability there. You know, Iraq is a long way from being this kind of functioning, stable democracy that a lot of people wanted it to be kind of around 2003. But, you know, it's getting there, and this is going to take decades. But, yeah, I mean, let's wait and see. I mean, I think the election's going to be huge. They'll be the first post-ISIS elections. Let's see. Are candidates really able to reach out across sectarian divides? And if so, I think that's a really, really good thing. And you know, we're seeing people always said, like, Iraq doesn't really exist. It just exists on paper. It's not a real country. Mm. It's not a real state. But I think the last kind of year has shown that's nonsense. You know, we've seen Iraqi nationalism come on leaps and bounds. Whilst we don't want to see them overdo it on the nationalist sense, there's a newfound national identity, I think, that's come off the back of defeating ISIS. Mm. This was like a global battle, and the Iraqis were the sharp edge of a massive international coalition, and they take pride in that, and they should. And I think that can be the basis for a new kind of Iraqi national identity, at least partially, and that's a good thing. That's gonna help the country kind of heal some of the wounds that it's seen in the last couple of decades.
And what about you? Where do you go from here? I know you say you're working at the National.
Yeah, so I've just started working at the National, which is based in Abu Dhabi. But we have a bureau here in London. You know, it's a great little... I think in London we have about six journalists. We work under Damien McElroy. He used to be deputy foreign editor at the Sunday Times. And it's a really interesting... It's very different, you know. I've never really worked in an office in London before.
Mm.
And I've also never really done stories in my own country, which is also an interesting challenge. But, you know, largely speaking, it's, you know, it's a kind of ambitious paper. It's got a lot of resources, and it's keen to kind of, you know, a lot of journalism is like just kind of turning around copy these days. But with the National, they really do put a lot of pride into kind of, you know, original content and getting out there and speaking to people and making your work unique and different from whatever other outlets are churning out. And I like that. You know, that's exactly what I was doing in Iraq. So it fits perfectly. And, you know, it's early days in the London Bureau at the National yet, but so far, I mean, I think there's some great journalists there, and there's a great chance for me to learn as well. You know, I never did a journalism degree. I never really had that formal journalism education. So now, for the first time, I'm working alongside, you know, very accomplished journalists who do have that, and they also have the experience on the ground. And, you know, I think that's going to be really good for me. So it's, you know, as well as just being a job, it's a kind of thing of personal development, professional development too.
Any plans to go to the Middle East or anywhere further afield?
You know, I'm always planning trips away. I'm sure it will happen soon enough. For now, I'm based in London, and I'm covering Europe, and I'm happy with that. You know, I'm sure I'll be back in the Middle East very, you know, soon enough.
Thanks very much, Gareth.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Cheers.
And for more from Gareth, you can head to www.thenational.ae. That was the Press Gazette podcast. I'm Thomas Kavanagh. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.